Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Are you wondering about America? Whether in recent years we've turned this corner and barreled straight into a lot of painful, toxic, dangerous division in this country? With polling showing majorities of Americans concerned about the prospect of some sort of violent conflict, are you wondering, is there a way out of this? Well, maybe there is. It depends on our willingness to get back to agreeing to disagree agreeably and to listen and to learn. And it might just begin right here in Kentucky. Joining us to talk about Meeting of America are Julie Babbage, managing partner of Babbage co-founder and Kentucky director for Meeting of America, and Pierce Godwin, founder and chief executive officer of Listen First and co-founder of Meeting of America. Julie and Pierce, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks so much for having us, Tom.
Thank you so much for having us.
And I'd like to begin with you, Pierce. What is Meeting of America and how did it come about?
Meeting of America is an unprecedented endeavor to decrease exactly what you were talking about, this painful, dangerous division in the country. We want to do so by gathering individuals from all backgrounds and beliefs just to recognize our shared humanity, values, and concerns. We firmly believe that as we move from just seeing those people as other, as the enemy, as a threat, as something to be feared, as in some cases, almost like foreign actors who we fear are against our values and everything we believe in. When we move beyond that, turn down that heat and just see the humanity in each other, then we'll be able to find a way forward together. And as you noted, it's going to first launch in Kentucky as conversations begin the week of October 24th.
Well, building bridges over these divides that we have in this country in these times seems like a pretty tall order. And I know that your polling finds 66% of Americans feel that when they talk about the issues with people with different points of view, that people seem to be quick to attack them or quicker than they used to be. What happened to that idea that we should agree to disagree agreeably?
There are so many factors, and all of them are right, at least partially. But we have found ourselves in uncertain times culturally, in times in which we have economic instability, we have social media allowing us to say things that I hope to God we'd never say face-to-face. We have political parties who have become more homogeneous, more aligned around the full set of issues that have gotten us into these all-too-neat camps of us versus them. And that's where the toxicity has been added into the polarization. I love disagreement. I love democracy. It is a wonderful part of who we are as a diverse American people. But when I don't just see you as my political opponent or as someone with a different background, but instead I see you as a threat, I want to demonize you, that's where it's toxic. That's where the demonization across differences puts us in a much more dangerous place. And listen, we all want belonging. We all want community. We're unfortunately finding a lot of that right now in terms of who we are against. And I hope we can find belonging and community at a higher level as fellow Kentuckians and fellow Americans.
Well, let's bring Julie Babbage into the conversation. Julie, the idea here, as I understand it, is to gather individuals from all backgrounds and beliefs to recognize shared humanity, values, and concerns. And the aim is to transform division and contempt into connection and understanding, to borrow a quote from you, Pierce. Julie, can we talk and listen our way out of this polarized social and political environment that we're in?
Well, it's not the whole answer, but it's certainly a start. And I think, you know, to begin here in Kentucky, a place where, you know, first of all, it's just real America. You've got what is traditionally referred to as the heartland. And I think that's something that's really special about this part of America, in addition to the fact that people here are in some ways willing to see beyond some of those differences that Pierce was just highlighting. In terms of our own efforts as a state to overcome tragedies in the East and the West with natural disasters, we've seen people disregard political party or their strongly held beliefs in order to help one another and come together. And when you bond over something you share in common with someone, when you're checking out of the grocery store and you've got a picture of your child in a soccer uniform And the clerk says, my kids play soccer too, and they look to be about the same age. Nobody asked anybody about a hot button issue. Nobody demonized the other. You have a shared connection in that moment with a person who you may otherwise not talk to. And this is the point, that as we become more tribal, as we become more suspicious of folks who don't align exactly with us, and as we're forced into camps to be told that anybody who disagrees with us, we don't just like them, they are an enemy to our democracy or to our country, you've created a monster, and we've forgotten how to have these conversations. So I really believe, and I know a lot of folks are with us on this, that conversation is the first part of coming together and just hearing each other and recognizing in the process that certainly we have things we disagree on, and we always will. That hasn't changed. But what has changed is an inability to find common ground or to even recognize our humanity in the process.
Right. We've become pretty good at talking to each other, especially enabled by social media. But how good are we these days at listening to each other?
You know, the great thing about this process is it's really set up that we are listening to each other. I think you're right on to something, that everybody wants to say their point. And the point of this whole endeavor is that you will be heard in the process, and we want you to come. You may think, well, I don't know if my points of view are really going to be welcomed here. They absolutely will be. And that's the idea. All of these different beliefs and backgrounds should be represented. Everyone should get to say something. So it's very much about sharing, but it's also about listening in the process with respect. And so the system is really designed. These are online small group conversations to ensure that the individuals in that small group who've been randomly paired with each other, but in a way that really maximizes the ability to have really warm, friendly conversations in the process of bonding over things that aren't related to politics, things that are just related to our everyday lives and to the experiences we've had. In that process, the system is set up to make sure that folks are listening to one another. You know, everybody gets to answer the question. Everybody gets to share a little bit in the process. And again, it's a really unifying experience. The goal is not to say, what do you think about this hot button issue that is really polarizing? It's to say, you know, we're all people. We have a lot more in common than we think. And when we share, and to your point, listen to one another, we figure that out really quickly.
Well, Pierce Godwin, back to you. I know this has been tried. There was a pilot Meeting of America that happened late last year involving people from supporting organizations, which range from Stanford to Liberty Universities. That's quite a range, and include Walmart, McDonald's, Dick's Sporting Goods, Target. How were such disparate organizations persuaded to get involved?
You know, one thing Julie and I don't have to do these days, Tom, is convince anybody that there is a problem, because it is hitting close to home. I think about it in terms of personal pain and national fear, whether you're losing friends and relationships and family vacations are being blown up because we can't disagree without demonizing each other, or if you are just deeply afraid for the future of the state of Kentucky and the country that we all love. Folks recognize that we've got a problem here and that the end game is not anything we want to live to see. So whether it's those, you know, leading national corporations and universities or everyday Americans like ourselves, people want to do something about it. And to your point, four times more Americans say they're willing to have this kind of conversation if they actually would be listened to. What Julie's talking about can seem almost too good to be true. So many of us, as you noted, Tom, are used to being attacked just for sharing our sincerely held beliefs, like so many of them just aren't allowed in polite society these days. Meeting of America is here to say no to that, that this is a place where we will all have the opportunity for free speech, to bring our stories to the table. And indeed, you don't have to take our word for it. As you know, Tom, we did this pilot, and 100% of participants felt heard. Folks from all backgrounds and beliefs, every last one of them said they felt heard. 82% said that it made them more interested in having these kind of conversations across differences. And a key point here, as Julie noted, we believe firmly that this is the first step to saving America, but it's not the last. And as part of Meeting of America, we are going to take that next step of working together to fix things we broadly agree are broken. And in that pilot, 86% of the folks said, we want to do that. We want to be part of this ongoing community. And then frankly, my favorite is that 79% of our pilot participants said the experience made them more hopeful for the future of the country.
Well, the next question I have for each of you is one that I thought I would never have to ask anybody. And that is that many people are saying these days that the America that we have known is being destroyed by this division that we're experiencing.
Yeah.
Starting with you, Pierce, do you agree with that assessment?
I agree that if we don't do something about it, if we don't turn the tide, that is what will happen. This toxic polarization has been described as a singularly virulent and dangerous phenomenon, as by our national security experts call it, our greatest national security vulnerability. 35% of partisans now believe that violence could be justified to advance their party's goals. 61% of us say that we're concerned the U.S. could be on the verge of another civil war. 43% think it's at least somewhat likely in the next decade. And devastatingly, 14% of our fellow Americans, that is not a small number, believe another civil war is very likely in the next 10 years.
Julie Babbage, what's your thought on this?
Well, I also like to take the hopeful tone, and the statistics are incredibly scary, and we know that. And Meeting of America really is about hope for the future. I mentioned that there are times when we see that humanity displayed that's such a change from what we've seen, whether it's tornadoes or floods. We recently celebrated, and mourned another anniversary of September 11th. And I've seen it said that, you know, I would never wish for another 9/11, but I want that 9/12, that next day feeling when America was so united, to come together and lay everything aside to stand up for this country. And so we're missing any opportunity to be unified, you know, save for disaster, which is such a sad way to be and to be becoming as a society. I think that really the deck is stacked against the people. The incentives are misaligned. So individuals are feeling more and more helpless, right? And so that's really impacting our ability to feel hopeful, right? The point of this project. And in the process of that, there's a lot of profit that is made in driving people apart. There's a lot of gain and power that is made in driving people apart and in making enemies of one another. So if we can't take our power back as the people, then we are at risk of seeing the America we know and love forever changed. I hold on to the hope that will never happen, and that this country is so much greater and the experiment must continue, and that if push comes to shove, Americans would by and large stand up. But we're getting to a breaking point that so many have identified, and I think it's time to do something.
All right. Julie Babbage, Kentucky Director for Meeting of America. Pierce Godwin, co-founder of Meeting of America. Good luck, and thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you so much for having us, though.
One thing that it means to be American is to enjoy the right to vote. But what do you know about the roles of the state and local offices on the ballot? We're working in partnership with CivicLex Director Richard Young to define those job descriptions. So far, we've covered constables, magistrates, and county commissioners. And you can find those episodes on our site at esweku.org. Click on the tab labeled Civic Shorts. This week's focus, the county sheriff.
Kentucky has had four constitutions, and the sheriff's role and term limits have changed slightly throughout each of them. Under the state's first constitution in 1792, the office of the sheriff was elected with a three-year term. In the second constitution in 1799, the sheriff's office had a two-year term, and multiple candidates were nominated by the county court, and then the governor chose from a list of those nominees. In the third constitution in 1850, the sheriff's office was again made elective with a two-year term. The state's fourth and current constitution was adopted in 1891, and in this constitution, the sheriff's role stayed elected with a four-year term. Sheriffs and police officers do a lot of similar things but can have very different roles. Sheriffs generally hold a lot more power. Police officers are solely responsible for crime prevention within city limits, but sheriffs are elected higher authority and are accountable for crime prevention for the entire county. In Fayette County, the sheriff's responsibilities fall into four categories: tax collection, election dues, services to courts, and law enforcement. Specifically, sheriffs are responsible for serving court documents like criminal warrants, subpoenas, and mental health petitions. Sheriffs can also provide victims of domestic abuse with resources and help them navigate the criminal justice system. They verify registered addresses of convicted sex offenders within Fayette County, and they serve as the primary collector of ad valorem taxes. In Fayette County, the sheriff spends most of their time on civic duties instead of law enforcement duties. In 2022, Kathy Witt is on the Fayette County ballot running as a Democratic candidate for the Fayette County Sheriff as an incumbent. She is running against Christopher Holliday, who is registered as a Republican. Want to learn more about the positions on the ballot in Fayette County? Head over to lex.vote to learn more. Want more information on all things local government? You can check out our website at civiclex.org. From there, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and follow us on social media. From Civic Lex for Eastern Standard, I'm Richard Young.
Coming up after the break, the cost of childcare in Kentucky.
It's on par with a mortgage payment.
Kayakers step up to support flood recovery.
We really felt that we needed to do what we can to help out our local community.
And a new conductor for the Lexington Philharmonic.
My first love for music was to jazz, and that's how I came to music, through jazz.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power and energy usage information to co-op members. Co-ops offer an online energy assessment to help evaluate energy usage. More information at your local co-op's virtual energy assessment link. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Pay and staff cuts, even closures, are on the horizon for many providers of child care in Kentucky. That fundamental piece of our economy that makes it possible for parents to go to work. A report from the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence tells us that nearly 3 years into the pandemic, Kentucky's child care sector is on shaky ground and bracing for more trouble ahead as a steep funding cliff nears. Joining us is Benjamin Geese, the author of A Fragile Ecosystem, COVID-19's Impact on Kentucky's Child Care Sector. Welcome, Ben.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
And we want to talk with you about the fourth edition of the report, A Fragile Ecosystem. What stands out to you as the most important changes since that first report was published back in June of 2020?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think what stands out to me more so than anything else is not so much changes, but rather the fact that what A Fragile Ecosystem 4 discusses is still the tenuous nature that Kentucky's child care sector finds itself in. All these years later, after the report, Fragile Ecosystem 1 first debuted in 2020, those reports were really intended to show the ill effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the sector, and they did that to great effect, and we were very grateful for both the state and the federal support that Kentucky's child care sector received, thanks by and large to the data recorded in those reports. But if you're asking me about changes, I think I'm most struck by not so much what's changed, but rather what stayed the same. Because if we take a look at this report, even after all of the COVID-19 relief funds, which I will stress the word relief there, in that those were given for a very particular purpose at a very particular time to really stop the hemorrhaging that was taking place in that sector, as was the case in so many sectors at that time. What this report finds, however, is that once the most recent edition of federal COVID-19 relief dollars run out, those from the American Rescue Plan or ARPA, we see that 70% of providers said they would be forced to raise tuition for working families, 40% of providers indicated they would be forced to cut staff wages. Almost 30% said they would have to lay off staff. And another 20% indicated that they would be left no choice but to permanently close their center. So to me, it's not so much what's changed, but what's remained the same and what still needs changing.
Lots to look at here. First of all, it's always perplexed me that childcare is such a fundamental piece of the machinery of our economy, yet it's kind of an afterthought in some respects. That needs to be remedied.
Most certainly. You know, when we talk childcare, we like to say it is the workforce behind the workforce, and it is the one sector that props up all the other sectors of not only Kentucky's economy, but the American economy. So I think in years past, it's certainly been an afterthought. But one of the, if there could be anything positive that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic, was really laying all of society bare. It removed a lot of the noise and helped us to see, you know, some problems that we had faced in our city and our state and our country for a very, very long time with a clear set of eyes. Childcare was a beneficiary to that particular part of the COVID pandemic, in that when the center shut down across Kentucky as a part of safety protocols back in March of 2020, people really started to see how important childcare was in their everyday lives, whether you be a current parent, whether you be a grandparent, a kinship caregiver, whether you be an employer, or just a general member of the workforce or of the community. We really began to see that once those restrictions were lifted, part of the reason why it took the economy, and it still continues to take the economy a bit longer to rebound, is because it was hard for parents to go immediately back to work. Their child care center remained closed or perhaps had gone out of business, and that kept a lot of Kentuckians from the workforce, and that's something that we'd like to remedy.
Earlier, you mentioned relief, and I mentioned a steep cliff coming up. Let's
Correct.
Put those two things together, because that relief is about to come to an end. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yes. And so Kentucky, as the rest of the states, we are very grateful to receive from the federal government a number of relief dollars in the most recent COVID-19 plan passed by the U.S. Congress, the American Rescue Plan, last summer. Now, the problem with federal money is that it eventually does go away. That money has been used wisely throughout the arc of the pandemic by Kentucky's Division of Child Care and the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. It's done a lot of good, but those funds are coming to a close. Those funds will expire prior to the close of the 2024 state budget session in Frankfort, and likely a bit before then. So if we're talking about, you know, all of the good things that relief money was able to do, it's also important to look on the flip side and say, so without that money, where will the sector be? And sharing a little bit from a fragile ecosystem four, we like to say that once those funds are gone, the sector will be essentially where it was on March 13th of 2020, without lockdowns and without the pandemic. So our leaders in Frankfort have quite the task before them.
I'll say, because this is going to expire before that budget session, and I'm just wondering, I don't know, maybe one of our listeners can help us with this, maybe you know, but can a budget item be taken up in special session to close that gap? Because we're talking about this money ending before there's an opportunity to even refresh it.
Well, we do know that there have been times throughout Kentucky's history where there have been particular items of the budget reopened in a general session. We've heard some talk of that, but we've not exactly heard a chorus of support for that. And I think it's important to keep monitoring the use of these funds and exactly when they will run dry in making that decision. And that's something that we've been working with the Cabinet for Health and Family Services on. Although if you're asking for a particular date on the calendar in which that will happen, we're not exactly clear on that particular date just yet.
I know that there are policymakers in the executive branch of government who do realize that this is an urgent matter. Does that urgency translate over to the legislative side? Is there a plan among policymakers, legislators in Frankfort, to keep the child care sector from plunging over that funding cliff?
I think there are certainly ongoing discussions and strong support in the legislative branch as well as in the executive branch. One piece of work that I would like to highlight is the excellent work of both Senator Danny Carroll and Representative Samara Heverin, who are both co-chairs of the Kentucky Early Childhood Education Task Force. That task force has been meeting since June, about once a month, really tackling some of the most pressing problems in early childhood in preparation for this upcoming session. We were honored to have both Senator Carroll and Representative Heverin at our press conference at the state capitol last week, sharing their concerns regarding this cliff as well. So, you know, at the Pritchard Committee, we like to say our model is to study, to inform, and to engage. And so with the creation of the survey, we studied. With the production of this report of Fragile Ecosystem 4, we informed. And with the press conference and this interview today, we are engaging. And so our formula is that those three things add up to action. And so that's something that we are still waiting to see. But I think it's incumbent that now, given the resources, given the data and the information, that our leaders act to ensure that working Kentucky families retain their access to child care.
Well, while the subject is open and policy is being formulated, should it be taken into consideration that already existing before the COVID outbreak was the matter of affordable child care? Hasn't it been true that in many would-be two-paycheck households, one parent ends up doing the math and figures out that their paycheck would just be eaten up by child care costs? So what's the point of leaving their child or children to the care of somebody else? Is this factored into the discussions that are going on, do you know?
Most certainly. You know, when you look at the cost of child care in Kentucky, it's on par with tuition at a four-year state college or university.
Wow.
It's on par with a mortgage payment. So when we take a look at affordability, it's important to talk that, you know, unless you're independently wealthy, it's hard to afford this in a normal middle class or sometimes even in an upper middle class household, let alone a household that may be touched by poverty, or let's say, you know, just a single mom or a single dad out there working for the betterment of their children. So you are correct. It is a huge barrier to the workforce. One piece of legislation that I would also like to lift up that thankfully passed in the last Kentucky session was the Kentucky Employer Partnership Program that was also sponsored by Representative Heverin. That allocated a number of funds really to incentivize employers and the state to work together to offer child care for employees. So that is a solution here, but it's not the solution. It's going to take sustained investments in the sector long-term to really get it to where it needs to be. Because one thing I want your audience to understand after listening to this interview is that the child care crisis in Kentucky existed long before the COVID-19 pandemic. This is not simply a product or a byproduct of the pandemic, but rather something that has been going on in the state for truly decades. I know, as I discussed with a colleague yesterday, it would be wonderful to show up in Frankfurt for a state budget session and it not be a true do or die moment for the sector, or a hair on fire moment for the sector. But rather, let's invest wisely. Let's stabilize the sector once and for all. So that way, when we can go back for a next session, it's not do or die. It's not hair on fire. But we can talk about innovation. You know, it's hard to add an addition to your house if there's a fire in the kitchen. So if we can put out that fire in the kitchen, metaphorically speaking, we could really innovate and get this right for working families across the state.
What about the difference between child care availability and affordability in urban settings versus rural? That seems to be a separate issue.
Well, yes and no. I think it really depends which subset of the issue you're referring to. But if you take a look at our study of Fragile Ecosystem 4, we had 94 of Kentucky's 120 counties respond to this, by and large, saying about the same thing. So whether you're from rural Kentucky or urban Kentucky or any type of Kentucky in between, child care access is a real issue, regardless of where you may call home. Even in more urban areas that are not identified as childcare deserts, you still have pockets of more urban areas, such as in the city of Louisville, where there are childcare deserts. West Louisville being an example of that, where in that particular part of the city, in that particular neighborhood, parents still struggle to find high-quality care in their area that allows them to, you know, efficiently go to work and efficiently come back home, and in the in-between time know that their child is safe, loved, and cared for during that time.
Well, Benjamin, if a listener is interested in exploring your work, Fragile Ecosystem, where can they find it? Can they download it from the Pritchard Committee site?
Yes, absolutely. It is on the Pritchard Committee website. At the moment, it is one of our banner items at the top. So as soon as you go to our website, you will see it there.
Okay. And we'll also post it on our site as well, esweku.org, and make it available that way as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
It's Benjamin Geese, Director of Early Childhood Policy and Practice for the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. He is author of A Fragile Ecosystem, COVID-19's Impact on Kentucky's Childcare Sector. Thank you, Benjamin.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
He left for work and he never came back. Now Mary has to face the fact that it's up to her to start a new life. Two kids and just one job, it's gonna take all the strength she's got. Well, it's a hard road, but she knows somehow she'll survive. Making ends meet, holding her own, not afraid of a hard day's work to give her family a home. Ain't nothing gonna break her stride. There's too much love and pride, standing on her own two feet, making ends meet.
Melise Brune becomes the fifth music director and the first woman in the role in the 61-year history of the Lexington Philharmonic Orchestra. A native of France with six diplomas from the Paris Conservatory, in the U.S. since 2010, she joins us to talk about her ideas and plans for Lexville. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Melise.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Rich Copley reported in the Herald Leader that you thought that you were just picking up a last-minute guest conducting gig when you came to Lexington back in May to lead the Lexville season finale concert. You were just filling in for the final candidate for the orchestra's open music director job, who had withdrawn from consideration, and you were just coming to conduct, not to audition. Well, fast forward to where we are today, and here you are. You've become Lexville's new music director. What happened to turn a fill-in gig into what amounted to an audition?
Well, that's one of maybe the best story of my life. That's what happened. Yes, I think no one really saw me as anything else than a guest conductor, myself included. And I'm used to do guest conducting. So, you know, I came to do my job as per usual and be very dedicated to that, and quickly transformed with different energy, different kind of attention, different synergy also between the people. And yeah, quickly I was offered the job, which is a dream.
Let's talk about that synergy, because it's real important here, I think. And what was your impression of the Lexville musicians as you rehearsed with them prior to that concert in May?
Yeah, so, you know, I started rehearsals on a Tuesday, and the concert was on a Saturday. And quickly, I noticed that the musicians were very eager to be pushed. Like, I'm rather a demanding type with really precise ideas and of the music. You know, I spend a lot of time figuring out an interpretation and sharing it with the musicians, while also listening to what they have to offer and what do they bring on the table. And I quickly noticed that they were giving more than 100% that they have, and they really wanted to be pushed and really wanted to go for really high level interpretation of the music. And from rehearsal to rehearsals, everything was just going exponentially. I think also what was very I noticed a lot is like they were really craving to be treated with respect and to have that person who would be listening to them and respecting them in front of them. And I think it's one of my ways of leadership, and they probably also appreciated that. But I think it would be good also to ask the musicians, you know.
Well, very clearly you made quite an impression, because word is that the orchestra gave you a standing ovation after the dress rehearsal, I believe. Is that right?
At the end of the dress, they applauded me for such a long time that it was really embarrassing. I didn't know what to do with myself at that point. And but I'm very thankful at the same time, you know. But I could have given that back to them. And I also thank them a lot, because it's been both ways. It's me giving to them and it's them giving to me, and for the good of the music and for the good of the concert. So that's why I'm always embarrassed with so many people giving so much applause, because it's a teamwork, you know.
So in the afterglow of this energy, people got in touch with the search committee chair and also Lexville board president, Carol McLeod. And they asked her to reconsider not including you in the search. And you ended up spending some time with her to talk about the job. She even took you to a horse farm, I believe. What was your impression?
I was really surprised, because I didn't know what was going on, of course, you know. And Carol took me for that horse farm's visit. I had mentioned that I really enjoy horses, and part of my family is in the horses business in France. So I really wanted to go and spend 2 hours together the day of the concert. And we went to see different horses and pet them and, you know, spend a great time with them. But what surprised me is, like, she made me an offer at that point, you know, and I was just going to see horses and to pet horses. And then I got a job offer at the very same time, which was so emotional for me. I almost cried, because I did not expect it.
Well, things move very quickly from there. Again, from that Rich Copley article, I understand that you made an incognito stop in Lexington for the Philharmonic's traditional July 3rd patriotic concert, and you were on your way to conduct in West Virginia on July the 4th. Did anybody know you were there?
So I decided that on my own, you know. I mean, nobody asked me to do it because I was not official. I mean, it had not been announced. Everything was signed and I had started working already, but it was not official. And I really wanted to see what is that show and how are things going, because I'm a very passionate person and I like to do things well. So I'm going to Charleston, West Virginia. Why not driving instead of taking a flight, stop by Lexington, you know, and spend the entire day being in the city, looking at the atmosphere. What is a crowd? What is the ambiance? What are the pieces? How does the crowd react to those pieces? But the thing is that I needed to make sure that nobody sees me, you know, because then they would know, something is happening, you know. Uh-huh. So I was like incognito, total 4th of July outfit, glasses and things. And I went kind of very close to the stage. None of the musicians recognized me. And only the administration of the orchestra knew I was there. So I spent the evening sitting on the ground with Carol, you know, and listening to the concert incognito and taking notes on what to make for next year in terms of programming and things.
You know, we usually talk about the music that's being performed, but we rarely talk about the instruments that make the music. And I understand that you play a bunch of them: cello, trumpet, French horn, piano, strings, brass, and keys. Is it important to you as a conductor to understand the capabilities of the instruments before you?
Yes, Tom. So I have always been, as a kid, very, very drawn to the sound of the instruments and producing sound of the instrument. I could not hold myself quiet in a room. If you put me with an instrument, I have to go to the instrument and play it. That was always like that. Unfortunately, my parents were not really open-minded to me doing a lot of things, so it had to be the cello and that's it, you know. So friends would give me their instruments, like trumpets, and I had to hide them at home. in a place that my parents would not find. And every time they would leave home, I would pull out the trumpet and start playing, you know. So I had to do a lot of things on my own like that, because I was so much drawn to the sound of the instrument. And also what really attracts me, I played in bands, but also in orchestra. So I have all of those sounds and how do they mix together. That's what really attracted me, you know, to orchestra and orchestral conducting. And it's my true belief that as a conductor, you need to understand as much as you can about each instrument.
Speaking of the music now, what are your views about genre bending, breaking down the barriers between music forms, the categorization that we tend to fall back on?
Yeah, you know, I'm big into that because I'm really generally in my entire life against putting things in boxes. I think it's too much reducing. And as artists, we need those connections. We need to think outside of the box. And I really think that it's also really important for us as orchestras in America to be more open to collaborate with other artists. I've, like, for example, Divine played with the Lexington Philharmonic, which was fantastic, and I hope we can develop that more. And all of these collaborations with different, like, hip-hop, jazz, but also with ballet, dancers, contemporary dance, with poetry. You know, there are so many things to be done in order to be more accurate with what people like.
This is so interesting to me because it seems like there would be tension between the improvisational dominance in jazz versus the structure of classical music. What kind of innovations can we anticipate here?
Yes, that's very good to mention that. So jazz has also many, you know, ways of performing jazz. You have a lot. If there is a form of jazz that is very written, and there is a form of jazz that's a lot more improvised. In classical music, you have also some composers who experience giving freedom to the musician and letting them, for example, some of the pieces we will be doing, like at the first concert, there is part where the percussionist players have a group of notes, but no rhythms and just indication of how to fit in the ensemble, which I see also like improvisation, you know, with a certain number of notes. So I think, like, it's part of the training, and that's why I love also teaching, is how do you bring that to the students while they are students? Because through conservatories or university, often we are just limited as classical musicians to read the music, not to play by ear, not to start improvising or let go. And I think a lot of that comes through the education that we give to our players to be more open-minded and trying different genres while they are studying and performing.
How does an orchestral organization like Lexphil evolve in the 21st century to be stronger, more meaningful as a community partner? And what does it mean to be, in practice, a meaningful community partner?
Well, in practice, it means to be relevant in your community. And what does that mean, relevant? It means feeling a need. You know, there is a need in the community. So if you're not at all satisfying that need, you are not relevant, you know? So it's really understanding where is the city at, where is the community at, what do we need to bring, what do they want, but also what do they do not know they will love, you know? Identifying all of these needs and bringing it to them. I think it's also, I mean, my ideal is kind of to have great collaborations with the musicians also, because often the musicians are left out of the equation in terms of decision-making and involvement in the community. And I think it's going to be one of the big changes in the future. We have seen it for conductors already. If you take a conductor in the early 80s, they were just coming, conducting their piece, treated as maestro, and boom, go back to the hotel room and leave. Now it's required, and thankfully required from all the conductors, to have all of those skills of fundraising, going to the patrons, being in the community, understanding what are the different games we can have with different people or not. But I think the next step is going to be for the musicians also to get there. And that's going to come through education first, where they learn those skills of marketing, of talking about the music, of being more involved about the pieces they want to play. Because it's so many times when you are at school, your teacher is going to tell you, you're going to play that Bach cello suite now. When do we make the students more responsible in terms of choosing what they want to play, how they want to play it, and all of that? So it's going to be one of the biggest steps when the musicians also have that decision-making and being part of the community, understanding who lives here and they really want to play for them and bring their art to them.
It's wonderful. Well, with your appointment, Melis, all of the top leadership positions at Lexphil now will be held by women, including Carol McLeod, Executive Director Allison Kaiser. It's quite a sea change from years ago. Your thoughts about that?
Yes, it is, you know, and I seriously never thought I would experience that during my life. And now it's, for this organization, that's great to have the exact opposite from what we have known. And we will see what it brings. Does it bring something different? And I think it's going to be very inspiring to see, like, okay, that's normal. And I grew up with that model and I know I can do it. For me, as a young woman, as a teenager, that would probably have changed my life to see that in my town there were these women in position of leadership and that can help the community and change the world.
Melis Bernay, the new music director of the Lexington Philharmonic Orchestra, Lexphil, and we welcome you to Lexington. Thank you so much, Melis.
Thank you so much, Tom, and everyone. I look forward to meeting you at the concert next season.
We know there is this saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Well, the going got extremely tough with the recent flooding in eastern Kentucky. Kayakers can be a tough lot, and some of them are getting together to pitch in and help with flood recovery. Bob Larkin is organizer of the Russell Fork Rendezvous, a whitewater kayaking music festival happening at the end of the month in Hayside, Virginia. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. A pleasure to be on the show.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And if you would help us get our bearings, where is Hayside, Virginia, and where does the festival happen in or around Hayside?
Okay. Hayside is right on the Kentucky-Virginia border. It's actually where the festival started almost 30 years ago. It's about, a lot of people are familiar with the Breaks Interstate Park.
Oh, yeah.
And, it's about 10 miles from the Breaks.
So you could actually plan on staying there, I guess.
You could stay at the Breaks. We actually rent out some property from the Breaks for every weekend in October that kayakers come to from, you know, really all over the world. And it's called the Ratliff Hole Campground. And we use that as a fundraiser for the festival as well. And or they can stay at the festival. We have plenty of camping, and it's the Kiwanis Park. You know, the facilities up there are fantastic, and everybody in the town is fantastic.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell on it because we're talking about something else, but I got to say, the Breaks is astonishing, especially if you're not prepared for what you drive up upon. I've heard it described as the deepest canyon this side of the Grand Canyon, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and actually, you know, we do a race right through that canyon every year, and the Breaks have been extremely supportive. You know, just extremely supportive.
We have an interesting motto this year, come hell or high water. What are the thoughts behind that? I guess it's pretty obvious, but what can you tell us?
Well, that actually started before the flooding. You know, we've been, you know, we've for almost 30 years, you know, we basically start out at zero money every year and we raise all the funds to throw the festival. And at the end of the year, we give all the money away to charity. It's not the best business model in the world, but, you know, it works. And then with COVID and everything else, we actually had a couple of years where, you know, we couldn't really have the festival proper. So we decided this year, come hell or high water, we were going to throw the festival. And it just kind of seemed to tie in with the flooding as well.
Sure. Well, it also seems fitting that an event that revolves around a river would be connected with another that also relates to rivers and streams. So all the proceeds, as I understand it, from this year's event will be contributed to Eastern Kentucky flood relief?
That's exactly right. Like I said, you know, we raise all the money every year to throw the festival, and we give it all away at the end of the year. And we've been doing that for a long time and supporting a lot of both national and local charities. And this year, with so many people just devastated by the flooding and it being so close to home, we really felt that we needed to do what we can to help out our local community. You know, we really believe in that anyway.
Sure. And how will those funds be distributed?
Well, we're trying to make, you know, the biggest local impact we can. Some of the fellow organizers are gathering some local churches and things like that. And for at the end of the festival, we're going to you know, pick out a couple of these places, you know, like I know Blackie and Whitesburg and Hyman and Jenkins, you know, I was talking to people in Jenkins today. And then the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is a, you know, fine organization. Matter of fact, it was on your show, you know, a friend of mine had suggested when it was all happening, I was out of the state, and suggested when it was all happening that we would change the focus of the festival, you know, support the flood victims. And then when I was coming back, I'd heard an interview that you were giving to the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and that pretty much sealed the deal. So we will definitely be supporting them, but we want to also, you know, spread it out as much as we can.
I noticed on your site, Bob, the advice that this can't be said enough. It's a party. Expect loud music and talking until the wee hours of the morning, and pick your campsite accordingly. Earplugs are never a bad idea. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, we have, you know, the race is on the, you know, the Russell Fork River, and it's an extremely hazardous river. It's the oldest Class 5 river race in the country, and it really draws kayakers from all over the world. And when they get together, they like to have a good time. We warn people on the way in, you know, this is loud camping. If you want family camping, we have that available too. It is a, you know, a little bit of distance from the festival, but the, you know, the festival music will play late, and then a lot of times drumming, which is a big part of the culture, may start up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and you know, if they want to play till six, they may play till six. So, you know, people are duly warned.
As I mentioned, there is a website. You want to share that address?
Yeah, it's RussellForkRendezvous.com. And, you know, you get all the information for the festival. You can, through our festival gear store, you can get purchase, you know, purchase advance tickets or festival gear, or you can enter a raffle by Liquid Logics, who's, you know, a national company, and donating a really nice whitewater kayak of your choice. So, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. You can find out all kinds of information. And if you want to talk directly to us, you can, you know, just hit the contact us button, and we will respond as quickly as possible.
All right. That's Bob Larkin, organizer of the Russell Fork Rendezvous Kayaking and Music Festival, happening October 26th through the 30th in Heysight, Virginia. Thanks and good luck, Bob.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks to Madeline Peru for her song, American. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series and their hosts, our partners, radio plays, and so on. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. You know, we're open to ideas. Would you like to suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.